Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to the landmark 25th episode of NML Crossing, where I'm feeling quite a bit better than I have been for most of this week. So that's a very, very good thing. I want to thank the folks who reached out to check up on me and wish me a speedy passing of the allergies or whatever the hell it was that was in my throat or is still kind of lingering in my throat. It really, really meant a lot to me. Today we have a pretty interesting issue to discuss, but before we do, I had another mail call situation yesterday that I thought I'd share here. It's interesting. I tend to hold on to all sorts of ephemera, the countertop freebies, the stuff that when you're, paying for your books, there's those free things on the counter that I usually take one of or whatever, or maybe you don't, I don't know. But generally speaking, I always grab those things, no matter what they are, no matter if it's a series that I'm interested in or a company that I follow. If it's free and it looks like it's just an odd, bit and bob of a comics history in the making, I grab it, and I usually hold on to these things. Well, it was recently brought to my attention that there was a piece of ephemera put out for the Cataclysm storyline. It was a mock-up of the Gotham Gazette newspaper with the big proclamation that there was a quake, and some articles front and back. It's a really cool looking piece, and I never knew it existed. And since I was definitely going to the comic shop multiple times a week back in 1998, is when I was starting to make money and was very, very responsible with it. But I'm sure that this thing was a countertop freebie while I was there, and for some reason, I didn't pick it up. I don't have it, or I didn't have it, and didn't even know it was a thing until my buddy Walt showed it to me. He's like, hey, check this out. And I was like, holy cow, I had no idea that existed. And so I had to do the whole one-click buy now sort of thing. Wound up getting two copies of the Gotham Gazette. I didn't realize there were two in the package, but there were two. And got it yesterday, and it's a really cool looking piece. I might throw it in a frame or something. It's just neat. I got pictures of it up on the socials here, and like I said, I have two, so maybe we can figure something out to send one off to somebody who may dig it. And like I say, it takes special people to care about comics, but it takes especially special, and we can put special in quotes sometimes, people who really love the weird ephemera, and I definitely count myself among those very special cases. So we'll figure something out with maybe sending that off to somebody, but that's probably a discussion to have somewhere down the line. For now, how about we get into today's issue? We're looking at Batman Shadow of the Bat number 77, had an August 1998 cover date, so we're really burning through 1998 all of a sudden, right? It feels like we were just in March. Time flies, doesn't it? Now, the story's called Arwen's Theory of Devolution? Maybe de-evolution? There's only one E there, but Arwen's Theory of Devolution, written by Alan Grant, with pencils by Mark Buckingham, inks Wayne Foucher, colors Pam Rambo and Android Images, letters Bill Oakley, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now, before we get into the actual story here, one of the things that caught my eye as I was digging through the bins, looking to fill in these holes in my Shadow of the Bat collection, and by holes in my Shadow of the Bat collection, it's pretty much every single issue after, like, number five, so I didn't really keep up with that, as I mentioned back in the long ago. One of the things that jumped out at me is the very unique painted covers on this era. And it's painted by someone named Orbic, I believe. Some of them are signed. Most of them are signed, I believe. But looking at them, they're very unique. And I thought, at first blush here, it's like there's no way that these covers can be indicative of what's going on inside the book. And so far, they've all been pretty spot on as to what's going on in the book. This one, we have Batman with a blindfold, like stepping off the roof of a building, which seems weird. Seems like it could be like a metaphor for like being lost in Gotham, not knowing which way is up in Gotham post-quake, but no, it's literal. It's literal. We actually open our story with a blindfolded Batman. And he's doing a tightrope-esque walk across some exposed beams high above the streets of Gotham City. We then zoom out a bit and find out why he's doing this. Well, we see a well-dressed professorial type holding a goonish-looking buffoon at gunpoint. He, the gunman, seeks to disprove Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest. He believes that the truer statement has to do with the survival of the luckiest. And, I mean, maybe we can't argue that, though I don't know that that disproves old Darwin's theory. Maybe it's more the exception that proves the rule, huh? Maybe we'll talk more about that later. Anyway, we get some shots of viruses mutating, intercut with Batman trudging his way blindly across these beams. And at this point, you might just be wondering how in the hell we got here, huh? And so, how about we hop back into flashback land, 15 minutes earlier. Batman's patrolling through Gotham, and he passes by the ruins of Gotham University while on his way to deliver a batch of anti-cholera vaccine. He notices that the place is being looted, and he decides to pop inside to shut the looters down. And it doesn't take but a minute to neutralize the situation, probably saving their lives since, you know, shoot on sight is a thing right now. Now, as the dust settles, that goonish-looking buffoon from earlier emerges from the mathematics department with a female hostage. Upon seeing Batman, he gives up the gal and he runs off deeper into the school. Batman comforts the woman until he finds out that she's there to loot, too. We close out the scene with all the looters tied to poles to await, hopefully the police and not the National Guard, because, again, you loot, they shoot. Back to the present. Blind as a Batman is still doing the tightrope act while pleading with the gunman that people are going to die if he doesn't deliver this vaccine. The professor doesn't seem all that concerned and even starts like whacking at the beams to send, you know, vibrations down to shake him up a bit. Also, too, we get a bit more narration about adaptation and evolution to fit and survive certain situations. Back in flashback land, Batman is still giving chase to that goonish buffoon. He's entered a particularly dangerous part of the university, a part of the university that New York Magazine article would probably call a red tag situation. We follow the goon inside, where he passes by a classroom where a professor is giving a lecture about Darwinism, and how, due to the very bad thing that happened a few weeks prior, he's changed his views on old Chuck's theories. The way he sees it, Darwinism only works in idealized situations. When catastrophes occur, well, you can toss that all out the window, which I guess is definitely food for thought fodder in it, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that. I'm no expert on Darwin. I'm no expert on anything, really, but we'll do our best to maybe dissect this and discuss it a little bit toward the end of the episode. Now, back to the story. By now, Batman has made his way inside as well, and he passes by a busted-up candy machine, so he knows that someone's been here foraging. Now the professor notices the goonish buffoon lurking outside the classroom, and so he invites him in to listen to the lecture. At gunpoint. Batman arrives next, and he too is invited inside. At gunpoint. Our view flips to the perspective of the professor, and it's here we can see that he's been lecturing a room full of corpses. Now, he introduces his amended take on Darwin's theory, which is again survival of the luckiest. Back to the present, and our main man still walking blind. The professor says that catastrophes are the secret to evolution. Catastrophes don't care about how much skill, strength, or knowledge anyone has. It's all down to luck. At this point, Batman loses his balance and makes a literal blind leap off the beam. He manages to catch another beam just by the very tips of his fingers. He warns the gunman, who I'm going to assume is named Arwen, considering the title of the issue. So that's what we're going to be calling him from this point on. He warns Arwen that this building can collapse at any moment, and they probably ought to leave. Ol' Arwen says he hopes it does. He goes a step further by proclaiming himself to already be dead. He just hasn't laid down yet. Back to flashback land, where Arwen walks Batman and the goon upstairs to those exposed beams. He reveals that he's been here since the quake, and he only survived the quake because he'd stepped into a closet when the roof collapsed on his classroom. Since then, he's been living off candy bars and stale water, So I guess we know, you know, who's been foraging in those candy machines. He also happened across the gun in the principal's office. Do universities have principals? I thought they had deans. Who knows? Maybe they have both. Anyway, it's here where Batman is blindfolded and is forced to do his best Flying Grayson impersonation. Back to the present, Batman's still walking. Arwen starts firing in his direction to distract him. Just then, the goonish buffoon nabs the gun and pushes Arwen out of the building. Batman takes off the blindfold and dives to catch the falling Arwen. As he does, the floor gives way and the buffoon starts falling himself. Our man's able to snag the prof and swings him to safety. Now Arwen takes this as proof positive that only the luckiest survive. Batman, as you might imagine, is rather ticked off since, you know, this discounts all of his batty skills. Arwen is still dead set in his newfound ideology, and he claims that the cosmos is a joke and that life itself is an even bigger one. Batman slings the twit over his shoulder and delivers him to Hardbach, who just showed up. And he also hands over that cholera vaccine while he's at it. Dysentery, I don't know. Anyway, we close out with one of Gotham's finest offering Batman a cup of coffee, which he turns down, and then heads back into the lonely and destroyed streets of Gotham to do more good. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we're looking at Batman 557, and it's going to be... going to be the return of a new blood, which it might be fun to talk about. But that's next time. For now, let's talk about this one. And, you know, I thought it was another pretty good Aftershock issue. Here's the thing, though. So many, perhaps even all of the Aftershock issues we've looked at so far, I can't fight the feeling they're giving me. They're giving me, like, anthology vibes. Like, sure, there's enough story to run maybe 8 to 10 pages, and they're all, like, thematically similar. It almost feels like they'd be better as parts of, like, some oversized anthological one-shot. And granted, as I always say when covering comics in long form, the way I do things isn't the way comic creators intended their work to be received. Right? I do it wrong. I do everything a grand disservice. Where, like, getting a chapter of this every week where... you know, the Bat Book of the Week is just one book in your stack, this probably wouldn't seem quite as repetitive or perhaps episodic. My deep diving at a rate of one per day is probably the worst way to actually do things. I said that during X-Lapsed. I said that during, like, every project I've done. Because when you do it that way, and this is no indictment on talent or the quality of story, but the seams definitely show. And again, that doesn't mean that these stories aren't any good. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've enjoyed all of them so far. But it does make it pretty damn hard to come up with things to say about them. Not that my insights are insightful. It's just a little bit more challenging to approach the discussion portion of these programs here, where it's like, what do you say about something you've already said? You know? But with that said, let's try and talk a little bit about this one. At first blush here, this was a very Alan Grant issue, wasn't it? This falls in line with the mission statement of Shadow of the Bat, and it actually raises some pretty interesting philosophical questions. During that, I keep mentioning New York Magazine, I'm sorry for going back to that well as often as I do, but during our dive into that, we talked a bit about the phases that communities go through after a catastrophic event. You know, after the shock and empathy wears off, well, that's when questions and cynicism, that starts to fill the void. And it looks like our Professor Arwen, it looks like he skipped all the kumbaya stuff and went straight to this sort of crisis of faith. Eschewing the work and theories of Charles Darwin and taking a more random approach to evolution and survivability, and of course, that is only the luckiest survive. Now, this is an interesting topic, and I like that it's being used here because that train of thought kind of puts everybody on equal footing, like an equal playing field. It takes things like skill, knowledge, and strength off the table. And hell, it even takes things like preparedness out of the equation. This leans into a very... you know, the universe is random and chaotic school of thought, which I feel is very much a reasonable approach to take. it makes things like this less, I guess, personal. It's definitely a way to cope, right? I think, like we read in the New York article, when cynicism takes over, questions like why me or why us become very much the tone of things. You know, you look for someone to blame because it couldn't be your fault. And of course it isn't your fault. But when you reach that phase, you need to have someone accept the responsibility and blame, and almost. You know, it's just a human coping mechanism. And sure, I mean, after a tragedy like a 7.6 earthquake, it only makes sense for victims to behave like victims, right? Certainly, nobody in Gotham City was responsible for the earthquake. The lack of preparedness, sure, we can argue that. But the actual quake, that was just a thing that happened. In taking this survival of the luckiest approach, Arwen is almost, in a way, shifting responsibility for how he reacted and how he's currently behaving. Does that make sense to anybody but me? Like, you could be the strongest, smartest, most prepared person in the world, but bad stuff can still very much happen, and it's completely out of your control. You know, there's a saying, luck is for losers, but that comes with a caveat that luck will beat skill any day. Now me, I'm not lucky or skilled, so who knows? I do think this is a very interesting topic, and this Arwen fella is definitely an interesting study. It's very, very much an Alan Grant sort of character. Though we've only just met him, and we know very little about him outside of the context, we might assume that he was, at one point, a hardline Darwinist, probably right up until the quake. To see a man's foundational scientific beliefs shaken to the point where he proclaims that Darwin's theory wasn't just incomplete, but flat out wrong, speaks to the sorts of crisis of faith, conscience, and confidence trauma survivors can find themselves dealing with. I mean, even as Batman demonstrates and proves that it was his skill that saved the day, Arwen refuses to buy it. Like, he sees the proof with his own eyes, and it only makes him more steadfast in his disbelief. I mean, that speaks to trauma, the human condition. It's just, it's very, very interesting, and I really, really like that. And overall, I really liked this issue. Now, like I've been saying since the start, when I saw our to-do list for NML Crossing, I think I, like, vocally groaned when I realized how many issues of Shadow we'd be looking at. But I tell you, damned if this little series that could hasn't become a highlight. I mean, usually when comics, especially back in the 90s, say they're going to focus on psychology, well, it's usually going to be like a Vertigo book, but in outside of the Vertigo context here, they usually miss the mark spectacularly. Or they do that whole inch deep, mile wide approach. Or they use some buzzword straight out of the first chapters or first pages of a Psych 101 book, which I like to call the Heroes in Crisis approach, where you insert the word trauma and find yourself regaled with 10 out of 10 review scores and proclamations that you are, in fact, a genius. Ahem. Anyway, now, the psychology of Shadow the Bat, it's not perfect, nor does it go as deep as it perhaps could. But I gotta say, it is extremely well done, considering it's a mainstream superhero comic that came out before, like, the Bendicized Talking Heads era of modern comic book storytelling. This is really all you could ask for from a book with a psychological bent, from mainstream superhero comics, from the time it came out. So, definitely, don't sleep on this book. I mean, I had this pegged as a C or T, a D-tier book that we were just going to have to get through in order to get to the good stuff, and wouldn't you know it, a lot of the good stuff is here. So, definitely, Shadow is getting a weirdly high recommendation from me. Definitely check this one out. Don't sleep on it. It's really good stuff. Now, before we get out of here, let's hop into that NMA mailbag that I tried delivering yesterday, but boy, that was that was a grueling recording session. Boy, those folks who don't take to talking to themselves into a microphone, may not be able to appreciate how difficult that can be when A, you're not good at it, and B, you're sick. I tried. I recorded this bit a couple times yesterday, and I couldn't get through it. And I felt really bad about cutting it out, but at the same time, I felt like I didn't want to shortchange it. I appreciate anybody and everybody who writes in, takes the time out of their day to touch base with me. So I don't want to ever kind of just push through just, you know, to add a couple minutes to an episode, because that's, I don't know, it's just not productive. It doesn't do anything for anybody, especially when it's a fun and somewhat frustrating conversation like we're about to have here. This is a message from our friend Chris Yu talking about annuals. And of course, we've been talking about filing systems. We've been talking about how do we log these things in our crazy Excel spreadsheets? How do we mark these things? What gets what volume? What order do these things go in? It's a topic that the more well-adjusted comic enthusiast probably doesn't spend a great deal of time or energy on. But I'm insane, so I do. So let's get into it here. Chris says, okay. So like a lot of comics collectors, I used to put my annuals with the monthly issues right behind the number one issue of the ongoing series. But a few things changed my mind on this, and I started to view annuals as separate series near the end of my collecting days. You see, it all started with Tim Drake. And this is a story, this is one of the things that I got hooked on, or stuck on, too, is the Robin of it all. And I'll let Chris explain here. He says, the first Robin miniseries ran from January through May 1991. Robin 2 The Joker's Wild ran from December 91 to February 92. Robin 3 Cry of the Huntress ran from December 92 to March 93. The Robin ongoing series' first issue was November of 93. Yet, Robin Annual No. 1, which was an Eclipso, The Darkness Within chapter, that one was released in September of 1992. Add to that Robin Annual 2, which was a chapter of Bloodlines, well, that one came out in September of 93. How could the first two annuals come out before the ongoing series even had its first issue? The release schedule goes as follows. Robin, Robin 2, Robin Annual 1, Robin 3, Robin Annual 2, and then the Robin ongoing series. The annuals have to be a separate series from the beginning because they predate the ongoing series. And yeah, I mean, that's, like I said, that's what I got stuck on too, was Robin, because of not only how do you file these things, but what volume do you call each thing? It's silly questions for sure. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to this one. It comes down to preference, but it is so frustrating. Chris continues. The second thing is Superman. Superman No. 1 came out in May of 1939. Superman Annual No. 1 came out in 1960. The Superman Annuals ran until No. 8 in 1964 and then went on hiatus until resuming in 1983 with Annual No. 9 and then continuing until No. 12 in 1986. Then John Byrne reboots Superman and Superman Volume 2 No. 1 comes out in January of 97 and is followed by Superman Annual Volume 2 No. 1 in 1987. So, Superman Volume 1 changed its name to Adventures of Superman with issues 424 in January of 1987, but it was followed by Adventures of Superman Annual No. 1 in 1987. The numbering from the first volume of Superman Annuals did not continue, as Adventures of Superman Annual No. 13, so it could be assumed that the first volume of Superman Annual ended with issue No. 12 in 1986. The ongoing series numbering continued with the same name change, but the annual series renumbering did not continue after the name change. Now, Superman Volume 2 ran until April of 2006 when it ended, and that was post-Infinite Crisis. The last annual of Superman Annual Volume 2 was No. 12 in 2000. The Adventures of Superman Annual No. 9 in 1997 was the last annual in the Adventures of Superman Annual series. Adventures of Superman reverted to being called Superman in May of 2006 and was said to be a return to Superman Volume 1. Of course, that's also Infinite Crisis. Chris continues. Then in 2008, Superman Annual No. 13 came out. But, question is, was this a continuation of Annual Volume 2, which it put out in Annual in 2000, or Annual Volume 1, which put out its last annual in 1986? To add to this confusion, the story in Annual number 13 was the conclusion to a storyline running in the pages of the now-restored Superman Volume 1. It couldn't be the next in the Adventures of Superman Annual series because that series last put out Annual number 9, so it had to either be the next issue of Superman Annual Volume 1 or Superman Annual Volume 2. But which one? Then Annual 14 came out, and to add it onto whichever series 13 belonged to. And yeah. Now, the whole Superman Volume 2 thing is so strange because it was the flagship for most of the time it was in existence. And now it's kind of just like, it's not really referred to all that much outside of, you know, the death and whatnot. It's so weird how, I mean, they don't count that as part of the legacy numbering, which stands to reason since they were running concurrently and it would be kind of a cheat if they did. But the way I always file things, especially post-Infinite Crisis when the title of Adventures of Superman reverted back to Superman, it was, you know, Superman Volume 1, including Adventures of Superman, back to Volume 1. Then I put Volume 2, and then after the New 52 and whatnot, Volume 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, however many there are now. But Volume 2 is kind of in there weirdly, you know, like it doesn't really belong where I have it. So it's like, where do I put it? How do I file it? How do I mark it in my Excel spreadsheet? Do I go from Volume 1 to 3, 4, 5 and then put 2 after that? These are the silly things that keep me awake. And forget about it when it comes to annuals. Those are just ridiculous. And I mean, timing being everything here, it's a valid question that Chris asks here with Annual 13 being the next one in both series. Is it like a merging of them? Who knows? It's just crazy. Chris continues. Then Marvel screwed everything up by dropping issue numbers and just using years, which was when I started considering Marvel's annuals to be merely one-shots and not part of any actual series, ongoing, annual, or otherwise. And yeah. Marvel, current year, DC has stopped numbering annuals, and they just use the year number, which I like because it's just like, how many Batman annuals number one do we need? You know, we don't need every year to be Batman annual number one. It could be Batman 2023 number one, you know, whatever. Cool, fine. I'm okay with that. Back in the day, Marvel did something like that, and I didn't have much of a problem with it. Until the year that they did them as team-ups. Because being as anal as I am, I need to be told where to file things. I've said file a million times today. So when it's like X-Men / Fantastic Four 1998, or apostrophe 98, do I file that with X-Men? Do I file it with Fantastic Four? The Fantastic Four don't get a second annual. That's their annual. Like, I suppose I could buy a second copy and file them one in each. But, I mean, that seems... that might be exactly what Marvel wanted from us back in the day, especially around 97 and 98. But it's just weird, you know? And, I mean, there were some pretty weird crossover annuals there. Like, I think there was, like, X-Force and Champions. And Champions hadn't had a book in ages. There was a Machine Man and Bastion one. Bastion never had an ongoing series, and Machine Man, at that point, I don't think he had an ongoing. He had a couple of minis, and maybe that M-Tech... the M-Tech series wasn't out yet. So yeah, he didn't have an ongoing. Just very, very bizarre. In fact, I think Machine Man had two annuals that year. I think there was a Cable / Machine Man, and then there was Machine Man / Bastion. So weird, so weird. So, like, where do you file these things? If you're as weird about this kind of stuff as I am, it's something that keeps you awake at night. Back to Chris. I've come up with a new category for numbered annual series. I call them intermittent series. There are monthly series, bi-monthly series, bi-weekly series, quarterly series, and annual series. But when annuals don't come out every year, they become relegated to being intermittent series. The numbering continues no matter how much time has passed between issues. So annuals are separate series from the monthly ongoing series, even though they sometimes stories begin in the ongoing series that conclude in the annual series. I'm looking at you, Judas Contract. It's just another one of those comics collectors only problems. And he ends with, see, I told you we didn't want to have this conversation. To which I say, no, I definitely did want to have this conversation because it's just, like you said here, it's a comics collector's only problem. It's so insane. But it's just a part and parcel of comics collecting. It's a question that we ask. It's usually a question we get mocked for asking. If we were to tweet at Marvel and be like, hey, how come we have another X-Men annual number one every year? They'd probably say, get out of your mom's basement or whatever, but or maybe they'd hit us with a how dare you care about the thing that you buy, the thing that you support, us with your money for. Who knows? Very adversarial relationship nowadays, and I guess for the last little while. But I these are the kind of conversations that I remember having in the comic shop, or rather that I used to overhear at the comic shop before all the conversations in the comic shop became about movies and CGC slabs. But these are fun and interesting and very frustrating topics, and they're very much a part of our weird little niche within a niche within a niche. And I love having these conversations, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them as well. Anybody who feels strongly or thinks I feel too strongly, please feel free to let me know. And I definitely want to thank Chris for taking what was probably a little bit of time out of his day to put together this missive and walk us down Comics Annual memory lane. I really, really appreciate it, and it was a fun conversation to have. But I think that's where we're going to leave it for now because my brain is still spinning from trying to figure out where things go. For me personally, I chuck them in the back of whatever volume of whatever book it is. That's how they go in my long box. It's just they're in there in release order, and they just sit there, largely unread because so few of them actually mean anything anymore. But that's me. Definitely part of the problem. Can't vote with my wallet, or can't vote against with my wallet, I guess. But what are you gonna do? Anyway. If anybody would like to chime in, please feel free to do so. You could find me many different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all the social media stuff. Find me, I'll be there. But before I head down another rabbit hole here, how about we close things down? I would like to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya.
Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks.